collusion, Robert Mueller, Michael Cohen, Paul Manafort, Stormy Daniels, impeachment, fake news. How many different words have been tossed around in recent weeks as we watch an amazing and disruptive news cycle play out? Although people were probably saying it was amazing and disruptive, let's say back in 1974 with Richard Nixon. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. But nevertheless, a lot of things happening. And at the center of a lot of what we talk about, of course, is President Donald Trump. Today, we're going to take a hard look at Trump through the lens of the American public with the distinguished and experienced political observer. And then for our big number of the week, we'll look at the number of Americans who say that our healthcare system here in the United States is the best or above average compared to other modern industrialized nations. I'm Dr. Frank Newport. Welcome to our Gallup podcast. And we welcome Ron Brownstein. He's one of our country's most seasoned and informed political analysts and observers. He's currently senior political analyst for CNN and editorial director for strategic partnerships for Atlantic Media. Ron knows as much about politics as probably anybody living and breathing in this country today. And Ron, welcome to our podcast.
Hey, Frank. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Quick question. How many different presidents have you observed, by the way, in your career as a journalist, commentator, and columnist? How far back do you go?
I started at the very, very end of Carter, but I think really the first White House I covered was Reagan. Covered the Reagan White House and have been writing about national politics since. 1984 was my first full-scale presidential campaign. I did a little coverage of 1980, but 1984, starting toward the end of the Democratic primaries and then on through the general, and it's been no looking back since then.
Yeah, fascinating water under the bridge during all that period of time. Donald Trump, we can't help but talk about him. Cable news channels love to talk about Donald Trump because I think it's really been great for the ratings. I think he said that at once, didn't he? Great for the ratings. People can't help it. At least we find that here at Gallup, Ron. When we talk about Trump, publish new numbers on Trump, we get incredible interest in him. So let's talk about Donald Trump. 42% job approval rating. Now that is through, as we're talking here, our weekly average that is through Sunday, August the 19th. A lot has gone on during this week as we're recording. So I'm going to ask you right off the bat, do you expect a lot of change after the Michael Cohen, the Paul Manafort discussions, revelations, court decisions, pleading guilty, jury decisions this week?
Boy, you would expect, you know, from what you've described, but no. I mean, I think it would be it would break the pattern if there was significant change. Hard to believe there won't be some change, but the idea that there is a straw that will break the camel's back, I think, is we are long past that. You know, I think the story about Donald Trump in a lot of ways, and this is one of them, is that he has accelerated, intensified, put an exclamation point on longstanding changes in our politics. And one of these changes is that I think the trading range for presidents is getting narrower as we get more polarized. I mean, the floor and the ceiling are becoming, you know, more closely connected and more impervious to change. And I think that Trump has taken this long-term trend, as many that we'll probably talk about in the next few minutes, and accelerated it. The idea that I do not think a majority of Americans will ever say affirmatively that he should be president. But the idea that he is going to collapse into the low 30s and people are going to run away screaming because of something he's done, I think that's pretty hard to sustain at this point either.
Yeah, let's put this in context. 42%. We were talking about Ronald Reagan, the first president that you dealt with, and his numbers were, you know, in the 30% range at some point, but went well up into the 60% range, came back down again. What you're saying is what we've seen at Gallup, of course, quite a bit of variation going forward for most presidents. But for Donald Trump, this range 40-45% is pretty much it so far. And that's not a great number, right? Historically, at Gallup, our average has been well over 50%. So he's kind of stuck down here in the low 40% range, which isn't great, at least looking back in history.
I think one of the big stories of the Trump presidency is that it is revealing as much about the country as it is about him. You know, in many ways, he's not a surprise the way he has behaved as president. Maybe he's pushed to the outer edge of the disruptive and volatile behavior that people expected. But, you know, people had an idea that they were electing someone who was going to more overtly target racial resentments, who had an incredible array of personal problems trailing after him, who was not respectful of traditional boundaries on the use of presidential power or of independence of law enforcement, all of those things. What to me is more revealing is that as that has played out, so little has changed. That essentially the people who are uneasy about Trump, who are uneasy or antagonistic to Trump from the start, have been reconfirmed. And some of his base, some of his support from 2016 has pulled away. I think that's clear on the white collar side, but not a huge amount. And I think it has told us more about the underlying divisions in the country, that essentially half the country feels so alienated from the other half that they are willing to support someone who behaves this way if they think it will help them advance their goals, and because they think he is fighting against those on the other side that they view as hostile to their own priorities.
Very insightful point there, Ron. Let's talk a little more specifically about who these people are. We know that Republicans and Democrats have a huge spread. Our numbers at Gallup show, you know, 85 to 90% of Republicans will say approve week in, week out, and Democrats usually single digits. Other than this huge divide based on people's personal political identity, what do we see? Racial, gender, age, right. There's some big cleavages out there that we're talking about, right?
Right. So, you know, I mean, after the 2012 election, I coined a phrase in which I said that it seemed that our politics is now divided between a Democratic coalition of transformation and a Republican coalition of restoration. And what I meant by that is that I believe the fundamental dividing line in our politics is between those who largely welcome the demographic, cultural, and even economic changes reshaping American life, and those who feel threatened or eclipsed by them. And again, this was a trend that predated Trump, but Trump has radically accelerated it. And I think he has moved the Republican coalition, as my friend Tom Davis, the former Republican congressman, likes to say, further from the country club to the country. I mean, his is a coalition that is centered on blue collar, older, rural, and evangelical whites that remains competitive among college whites, but less competitive than Republicans used to be, and is stronger outside of urban areas, right? Whereas you have the mirror image Democratic coalition that is younger, more diverse, more white collar, more secular, and more urbanized. Hillary Clinton won 87 of the 100 largest counties in America. She won them by over 15 million votes, but there are another 3,000 counties, and Donald Trump won them by 2,600 votes. So in essence, I think you have, you know, when people have this debate, well, is it culture or is it economics that draws people to Trump? I think it's kind of a false choice, as E.J. Dionne would say, because essentially, to a large extent, the same people are uneasy about cultural and demographic change and uneasy about economic change. I mean, if you look, Frank, for example, Trump won something like 26 of the 30 states with the highest per capita carbon emissions. And Clinton won 16 of the 20 with the lowest, because the states with the highest per capita carbon emissions are the ones that are most tied into either energy extraction or manufacturing, kind of the dominant industries of the 20th century, whereas the Democrats now rely on kind of the post-industrial places that are more about the growing industries of the 21st century. Same thing with immigrants, share of immigrants in the population. There are all of these measures now line up. And I think that is what has made our politics so volatile and vitriolic, which is that, as the phrase I like to say, is all the cherries in the slot machine now line up: culture, demography, economics.
Yeah, let's talk about culture for a moment. You mentioned that the Republican base, Trump's approval base, is largely white. Obviously, the country is becoming less white. People ask me all the time when I make a speech, why is it that this 40-42% of people won't move? As we talked about a little earlier here, we don't expect them to move much in terms of approval of Trump. Is this one of the reasons that these people are worried about change and see him as their lifeline, as it were, to hold on to America as they knew it without the kind of changes that we're seeing in these groups that are more Democratic?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think unequivocally. I've always felt the key word in the Trump lexicon was again, make America great again. If you are a 35-year-old Hispanic lawyer or African-American MBA, you may find things about America today to be imperfect or unfair, but there is no again you are trying to get back to, right? Same-sex couple in Georgia is not trying to get back to an again. What he is, I think, speaking to is this sense of loss, both in terms of cultural influence, but also economic opportunity for future generations among a large portion of the white electorate. And to me, the big question in the long run, you know, in essence, I think everyone on both sides, Trump supporters and opponents, can agree that his electoral strategy is based on squeezing more advantage out of a shrinking part of the overall electorate. And in the long run, as the non-college white share of the electorate drops by about 2 points every 4 years, even under Trump, I mean, obviously, this is a strategy of diminishing returns eventually. The risk to Democrats, I think, is that there is some evidence that as the white share of the electorate, particularly the non-college and evangelical white share of the electorate declines, more of them vote Republican precisely because they are declining. It's kind of a treadmill effect that the overall share is dropping, but the Republican portion of that share is rising, and it leads you kind of in the same place. And what, as I say, in the long run, this is betting, I think, on a losing hand, but that doesn't mean that this thing can't shamble along for a while and still win elections, especially given the distortions of the Electoral College, the Senate, and even the House.
And differences in turnout. You mentioned a minute ago Trump's shrewd, at least to reach this group, by emphasizing the word again, you know, make America great again, which to me raises a broader question about Trump's use of the media and his use of Twitter and his use of creating enemies on the other side. I think, in my own opinion, history is going to look back and say he may have stumbled onto this inadvertently. But Trump's overall approach to the public face of the presidency and the way he's handling it, at least in the short term so far, has worked pretty well. He's done something dramatically different, which has kind of fit the zeitgeist, at least for the moment, at least for this group of people we're talking about.
The tactic, I view his use of Twitter more as a tactic in service of a larger goal. And the larger goal is that I think Trump essentially presents himself as a wartime president to his supporters. Only the war is against basically blue America, against all the forces that he presents as threatening their interests and their status, whether it's kind of coastal liberal elites, the media, undocumented immigrants, NFL players who are disrespecting the flag. I mean, we have, you know, we've kind of evolved, and you guys have the definitive numbers on this. I mean, if you go back to the 50s and 60s, you know, it was possible for a president to have majority support in both parties, right? And the model was that presidents tried to be the president of all America. Now, that's eroded over time. And certainly, there were people who complained that either George W. Bush or Barack Obama really didn't give a lot to the voters and areas outside of their coalition. They were more focused on the priorities of their own coalition. Trump has taken that an unprecedented step further in that I believe that he uses the parts of America outside of his coalition as a foil. He basically presents them, it's not benign neglect, it's active hostility, where he essentially says to his coalition, all of these other forces are threatening you. All of these other forces that kind of combine in blue America are threatening you. And I am the last line of defense. And therefore, really, no matter what I do, you need me. You need me to protect you from that. And that has been very effective. And if you look at Twitter, I mean, the main way he uses Twitter is to pick an endless succession of fights, mostly cultural, many disproportionately racial. But Twitter is about the Trump tweets that take off are not those that tout an achievement. They're those that target a new enemy. And there's one, you know, like every 72 hours.
Absolutely. Those are great points. And I think we know from psychology that people like to have an enemy. And we also know that is, it makes them feel better to have an enemy. And we also know from Trump's history that this has been the way he's handled his business life. He'd love to have enemies all the way through since he first started taking over from his father's business community. So in some ways, the way Trump faced the world is the way he's facing the world as a politician, the same as he faced it as a business person. Ron, I want to get your insight on a couple of things quickly. We're facing the midterm elections now. Typically, of course, the party of the White House loses seats in a midterm. That would be the Republicans. What do you think? Most pundits now say Democrats are going to take over at least the House. Does that fit with your own views?
I think on balance, they are more likely than not to take over the House. But I don't think it's guaranteed at all, precisely for the reasons we're talking about, that there is so little give in the system and that there is such a deep trench between this kind of urban, suburban, diverse, info economy, Democratic coalition and this Republican coalition that is dominant beyond those urban centers. I mean, certainly there are a number of white collar seats that Republicans have been holding, even though they have been trending Democratic at the presidential level, that the party is likely to lose. In that sense, to me, this is the inverse of 2010, when you had all of those rural Democrats, the John Spratts and Ike Skeltons, who have been holding on for years, even as their districts have been voting more Republican, and then the floorboards just finally rotted and they kind of fell through. I think you're going to see that in the suburbs of Philadelphia, Minneapolis, Chicago, around LA, certain seats in New Jersey, Denver. Is that 24 seats though? And if it's not, that means Democrats have to win at least a few blue-collar, non-urban seats. Could they? Sure. They have opportunities in Iowa. They have opportunities in upstate New York, downstate Illinois, Central Valley, California. But there it is much tougher because, as your own data shows, look at the gap between Trump's approval among non-college and college-educated whites in your Gallup data. And because of that, because of this huge gap, you're not going to see, I don't think, a wave election in the sense of that it rolls evenly across the whole country. You're going to see a realigning election that further deepens the divide between this blue metro America and this red non-metro America, where Democrats may make some inroads, but are probably not going to significantly dislodge. I calculated the other day, Frank, Republicans hold 107 of the 120 districts where the rural population share is the highest. And that might change a little. You know, I mean, Democrats might win 3 or 4, but you're basically going to come out of this election, I think, with the divisions within the country more sharply etched than ever. And it points toward what a 2020 election that I think is going to look like the Battle of the Bulge between what America has been and what it is becoming. And to me, the overriding point about the Trump presidency is he is showing us just how deep our divides are. Because the fact that so much of the country is willing to accept behavior so far out of the previously acceptable norms of a president just underscores how alienated they are, I think, from the other half. Obviously, blue America will never look a red America the same after their tolerance of Trump.
Very interesting. Not necessarily a blue wave is what you're saying. Democratic Party, a lot of talk about it moving to the left because we've seen some candidates who have espoused closer to what we used to call socialism. Our data show that over 50% of Democrats say we like the word socialism. We don't know exactly what they mean by that. So this is a big debate in the Democratic Party. What do we think? Should the Democrats or would they be more effective if they move to the left? Medicare for all, guaranteed pre-K education, guaranteed annual income even, or should they be more moderate?
Well, first of all, this is the same. This is the other side of the same process that created Trump, right? As you know, essentially what we're talking about is like almost like an iceberg shearing off the blue collar, working class, conservative end of the Democratic Party over the last 30 years has sheared off and moved into the Republican Party. And that has made the Democratic coalition more liberal by taking away that conservative ballast. And it's made the Republican coalition more populist and more blue collar. The last three presidential primaries, according to the cumulative exits, exactly even divide between college and non-college in the Republican vote. And again, the Democratic Party becoming more diverse, younger, more millennial, and more white collar. And so, you know, and the white collar Democrats are a pretty liberal group. So the same class realignment is reshaping both parties. I don't think there is a absolute black and white answer to the question of whether Democrats would be better off moving left or not. I, you know, in the 90s, clearly the answer was no. I mean, Bill Clinton, you know, emerged after the Democrats had gotten annihilated in three straight presidential elections, and his guiding insight was we had to do better among the voters who we now think of as Trump voters, working class whites, rural whites, religiously traditional whites, because they were such a bigger share of the electorate at that point. And now I think clearly in the House and the Senate, Democrats need to win in some places that are right of center. So the idea that the entire party is going to be a Medicare for all party is never going to happen because, you know, there are not, it's not clear there are 208, there may be, but it's not clear there are 218 House seats that you can win with Medicare for all. Even in this election, as I said, to get over the top, they're probably going to have to win some places outside of metro areas that are more Trump friendly. But at the presidential level, to me, it's not clear. I mean, you know, there are two competing theories. One is that Trump is alienating a lot of traditionally center-right white voters, particularly white-collar white voters, and you need a nominee and an agenda and a platform that can reassure them. They want to leave the Republican Party. Your job is just not to scare them away. The other point of view says that in the end, it may be hard to get a lot of those voters over the line, as we see in the approval rating, and that you're better off trying to mobilize this new coalition that either didn't vote or splintered off to the third parties of minorities, millennials, and white collar whites. Empirically, I don't think one of those arguments is intrinsically better than the other. Are you better off with Joe Biden or Kamala Harris? You know, I'd probably say Biden, you know, Biden with Kamala Harris, actually, I think is the best ticket Democrats could nominate right now.
Well, you know, Ron, you've raised into my final question before we have to go there. You're looking ahead. You just named the ticket, right? Is that your ticket for 2020 for the Democrats?
As I said, the core choice Democrats face is mobilization or reassurance. Do you believe there are enough center-right white voters who normally vote Republican who are ready to say, we've had enough of Trump, I was willing to give it a try, but this is just too much craziness and volatility for me, and therefore your job is to reassure them. If that's what you believe, then you look at people like Biden or Terry McAuliffe or John Hickenlooper or someone like that. Or you say, look, Trump has really, really activated and alienated younger voters. Look at his approval among millennials in your polling. I think it's in the low 20s. Mm-hmm. And our job is to find a candidate who can excite them. Millennials will exceed baby boomers as a share of eligible voters for the first time in 2018. And millennials and post-millennials will be significantly more than baby boomers in 2020. Our job is to go out and find somebody who can rev them up. And that's, you know, depending on your point of view, either Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, or I think even more likely, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, someone like that. On balance, I don't think it's a slam dunk which one is a better strategy. On balance, I think that combining the two makes the most sense for Democrats, and that a Biden-Kamala Harris ticket would be very formidable against Trump, with the potential to win back at least some white voters, not only white collar, but blue collar and the Rust Belt, but also the opportunity to energize the really strongly anti-Trump young people who are not showing signs necessarily of turning out in bigger numbers in 2018.
Well, we'll reconnect. Let's say in 2020, maybe in May or June, and we'll see what your prediction is showing us at that time about what's going to happen in the Democratic Party. Of course, we don't know, to me, exactly for sure whether or not Trump's going to be the nominee then as well, for a variety of reasons. He leaves against his will, or he decides he wants to go on his own. But of course, all signs are now he wants to plow ahead and run again in 2020.
Frank, if I could just add one point, it's also not clear if Biden does not run, is there someone from the reassurance side who is of sufficient magnitude to really take on the more mobilization type candidates of Sanders, if he runs, Warren and Kamala Harris, who seem to me potentially very formidable. Other than Biden, is there someone? The one wild card, it would be, I think, if Beto O'Rourke won in Texas, which is tough. You know, it's easier. It's tough to get those last
points. Against Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz. If he won, I think there'd be a lot of discussion of him very quickly, a la Obama from 04 to 08.
We'll see what happens. Ron Brownstein, one of our country's most seasoned, and as we've seen, informed analyst. He's the senior political analyst for CNN, editorial director for strategic partnerships for Atlantic Media. Ron, great to have you with us on the Gallup podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
And our big number of the week, 27%. That's the percent of Americans who say that the United States healthcare system is the best or above average compared to other modern industrialized nations. That's obviously a low number. Another 27% say that our healthcare system is average, and 45% say that the U.S. healthcare system is the worst or below average compared to other modern industrialized nations. And that's the worst showing for six different dimensions that we measured when we asked Americans to compare them to other similar nations. That's our podcast for this week. We ask you to subscribe to our Gallup podcast, and you can listen to what we have to say every week, looking at the events of the world, our culture and society, through the eyes of the American public. I'm Dr. Frank Newport, Gallup Editor-in-Chief.